This episode of The Disciplined Investor is brought to you by Interactive Brokers. And Interactive Brokers has key competitive advantages for sophisticated investors just like you. IBKR's margin loan rates are from just 4.83% to 5.83%. In fact, IBKR was rated one of the lowest margin fees by stockbrokers.com. Compare IBKR's client low margin borrowing cost to other brokers like, well, Schwab or E-Trade, Fidelity, maybe even Vanguard, who charge hundreds of basis points above IBKR's low rates. Gain access to over 150 global markets for stocks and options, futures, currencies, bonds, and funds with low commissions, all from a single screen. The best informed investors choose Interactive Brokers. Of course, margin is only for experienced investors with high risk tolerance. You may lose more than your initial investment. Rates, of course, are subject to change as well. Get started today at ibkr.com/compare. Interactive Brokers is a member of SIPC.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Inflation is up and it's down. We have revisions and a weakening job market and the 10-year treasury trying to break below, well, 4%. And a new top dog is crowned. Our guest is Peter Schiff from Euro-Pacific Capital. All this and much more on episode number 938 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Welcome to the new highs, lower rates, and the hope that a rate cut, well, it's not going to spark further continuation of inflation trends. Andrew Horowitz here, and it's a great time to be a stock, isn't it? Or a bond. Well, I guess also real estate. Well, gold too. Silver. Not oil. Yeah, international actually. Good time for that. Not domestic small caps, but you get the idea. It's pretty much been a rally of unprecedented strength, particularly once again in the large cap growth area. The tech guys, you know the names. You know all the names. I'm not going to mention them to you because you know them all. The fact is that we've seen a really beautiful rally, all-time highs in the NASDAQ, S&P 500. A few of the indices are trailing a bit, but nonetheless, they're all picking up steam because the idea is there, firmly implanted in the psyche of investors that you know what's going to happen. Well, we're going to see lower interest rates when the Fed comes to the fore next week. Lots of money seems to be swashing around. IPOs are hot right now. There's money to be made. People are really excited. And it's exactly what we saw with Larry Ellison this week. Talking about money being made, he made a bucket full of it. In fact, he became the richest man in the world this week. He became the richest man in the world this week. Surpassing, who would have thought, Elon Musk with the amount of money that he has. And I can tell you that I go back a long time knowing who Larry Ellison is in the early days of Oracle in the 80s and 90s, particularly the 90s, and particularly then again in 2000s, when Larry Ellison was always challenging the other tech bros, right? The early days, we had the big guys, right? In fact, it was pretty intense. It was decades-long rivalries between Ellison and Bill Gates, and it was, I would say pretty much there were others too, but those two, it sticks in my head. I remember very distinctly who was going to beat the other. That was definitely a definition of who they were in the early days, a competition, but the fight for the richest person, that was a later development. It was really going to be who was going to be the tech dominant guy, who was going to be the guy that's going to win. And clearly between the two, Larry Ellison, the cool guy, right? The cool dude and the nerd with Bill Gates, let's take out Ballmer. Let's take out all the other names, right? Steve Jobs was really in a sphere of his own. Both of these names, Gates and Ellison, became incredibly prominent figures back in the, what was it? Starting in the 80s and 90s. And then it was like, well, that was that. Gates started making money like crazy. And Ellison was kind of left in the dust. Now, Ellison's 81 years old. He's 81 years old. And here's what happened this week. Oracle announced their earnings, which, by the way, missed estimates. It wasn't a great earnings number for the quarter. However, they came in with mind-blowing, eye-popping, crazy numbers in terms of their revenue growth. They had contracts from OpenAI, Microsoft, Amazon, and others that were projecting earnings for them, the revenues from multi-years, like quadrupling, going from like $17 billion to $44 billion to like $79 billion, then to like $130, then $145. Like 5 years, going from $18 up to like $145 billion of cloud revenue. Unbelievable. Stock up 35% on the day. Full disclosure, good news. Our clients held that in the managed growth strategy. That was a core position of ours. That was great. But now, Larry is the world's richest person. In fact, hold on to your seats, because he made $100 billion on Wednesday. $100 billion. These are numbers that governments talk about, and not all governments. We're talking about pretty much the United States, maybe not even Japan. The United States talks those kind of numbers. 81 years old, going strong, owns 41% of the company still. He stepped down as the CEO back in, I think it was 2015, 2014, I believe it was. But he remained on as the chairman, executive chairman, and the chief technology, CTO. So that's impressive. Let's take a moment before we get to the things that are going to happen. Our guest, talk about the economy. The elephant in the room is the 900,000 revision downward for jobs that comes after the latest 4.3% print of the unemployment rate. And it's hard to know whether this revision, by the way, is going to impact that 4.3% rate. I don't know. Is that included already? Is it that a different deal? Yes, it's a different methodology and way of calculating. But even with the CPI ticking a bit hotter, PPI a little bit softer, the markets are betting the Fed is like, you know what? Forget about inflation. Look at the numbers over here. Look at the fact that we've increased the unemployment rate. Look at the fact that the initial claims are 263 versus 236 last week. Let's look at the fact that 900,000 people really are not working and never have been for the last year. So that's going to be pretty important. I think these are topics that we're going to really dig into during this interview with our guest today, Peter Schiff. Let me tell you a little bit about who Peter Schiff is. I think that's kind of important to discuss. He began his investment career as a financial consultant with Shearson Lehman Brothers. You remember that name? After having earned a degree in finance and accounting from UC Berkeley in 87. A financial planning professional for over 30 years, he's the owner of Euro-Pacific Asset Management. He's a chief economist and global strategist at Euro-Pacific Capital, a division of Alliance Capital, and chairman of Shift Gold. He's a highly recommended broker by many leading financial institutions, newsletters, and advisory services. And one of the biggest things that he did to reach notoriety was in 2008, being one of the few economists who have had accurately forecasted the financial crisis well in advance. So he's authored several best-selling books, including Crash Proof, Crash Proof 2.0, How the Economy Grows and Why It Crashes, and The Little Book of Bull Moves. So let's get right to the discussion with the economic advisor for the 2008 Ron Paul presidential campaign, Peter Schiff. So, Peter Schiff, welcome aboard. Thanks for joining me again.
Oh, happy to be aboard.
It's been a couple of 3 years. I think the last time you were on was in 2022, but you've been going back. I think we date back to like 2011, you and I, was the first time you were on the show.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
All right, so 14 years ago.
Yeah, it was a while, so it was great.
Yeah, the last time then, 2011 was the last time the price of silver was as high as it is today.
I remember that. Dickie, every time somebody says the price of silver, I say Dickie. Why? Back in those days, I was at a lake house of mine, and there was a guy that was visiting next door. His name was Dickie. And he was telling us about all the silver that he owned that he had for years and years and years, and that he was never selling. And we're like, Dickie, just take a little off the table. It was like 45, whatever it was at the time back then.
Yeah,
remember that?
It's finally back up to just, it's almost 42 now. But of course, gold gold is $36.50. So gold, you know, back then, you know, the gold was about half the price it is right now.
Right. But I actually, gold's
double, but silver's kind of gone sideways. But I think that's going to change. I think silver's, you know, silver's gonna kick in here.
We'll talk about that. I actually bought some silver recently. I bought 10 ounce bars from Costco.
Oh, well, you should have bought them from Schiff Gold.
Well, that's true. You got Schiff Gold and Silver. We could talk about that.
Oh, yeah.
Let's go back to the beginning here. I want to talk about some of the things in your professional. I want to set the stage for people that maybe haven't heard you, although there's not that many out there that haven't because you're pretty popular. But also go back to some basics and then kind of build this up. The you know, you are a contrarian voice. You are oftentimes a contrarian voice in finance. I want to know, just how do you handle that? How do you deal with that?
Well, I mean, that's just kind of the role that I've played for a long time, you know, even within the Republican Party. I remember I was a big contrarian during the Bush years. I'm talking about George W. Bush. Those were the years that led to the 2008 financial crisis. And I was highly critical of the policies of both the Bush administration and the Fed at the time, and forecast that they would lead to the the financial crisis, which ultimately happened. And now I'm playing the same role again. I think the Trump Republican Party is actually much worse than Bush as far as the reckless nature of their fiscal policy and some of the other policies that they have. And I think the Fed is about to make even more mistakes now than Greenspan did then. And so I think the toxic combination of inflationary, monetary, and fiscal policy is going to do a lot more damage to the economy this time than last. And of course, you know, we did a lot of damage last time. So you can only imagine how much worse it's going to be now.
So, but, you know, comes with this these days, in the early days of you talking about some of this stuff, I remember back in before and during the financial crisis, you were very vocal and very critical and all that, but it was kind of like one thing because not a lot of people had a voice. These days, everybody with social media can be their own podcaster, their own blogger, their own micro blogger, Instagrammer, TikToker, and just shit all over everybody else, right? How do you deal with that? It happens.
Well, I mean,
it happens.
You know, it's a marketplace of ideas, you know, so a lot of people can get out there and you know, speak their mind, which is great. A lot of people say a lot of foolish things, but there are other people that say pretty smart things. But, you know, the public can vote and decide who they want to pay attention to. And I think, you know, my track record, you know, I'd put that up against anybody as far as forecasting is concerned. In fact, you know, one of the most recent news items that came out was earlier in the week, the government came out, I think it was Tuesday, and they revised down a year's worth of jobs reports by another 900,000.
Yeah.
And that's on top of some other revisions. But if you go back to the actual days where those jobs numbers were released that were better than estimates, and you look at how they were reported in the mainstream media, financial television, you look at what you know, the Biden administration said about them, the Federal Reserve, everybody was, you know, bragging about how great these numbers were and how resilient the economy was and how strong the labor market was. And every single Friday of the first Friday of every month when those reports came out, I did a podcast. And on every podcast, I said, these numbers are bullshit. Don't believe them. They're going to get revised lower. We don't have a strong labor market. We have a weak labor market. The statistics are just not picking up the weakness. And I said that every month. We now know that 10 of those 12 months ended up being misses, misses.
Yeah.
And seven of them, which they were originally reporting as beats, all seven were misses, right? They were celebrating them. They were great. And for all I know, there's even more revisions to come. So, you know, people were able to get the truth about the markets from me. They didn't get it from the mainstream media. And by the way, gold stocks are now up so much, not even counting today's gain, but the 10-year return on the gold stock index, the GDX, is now substantially ahead of the 10-year return on the S&P. So people who bought gold stocks 10 years ago have gotten a better compounded return than people who bought the S&P. And gold stocks are still cheap, whereas the S&P is very expensive.
You know, it's interesting because it's funny. You talk about how the economic numbers and the estimates were wrong or incorrect or overdone or something was wrong. Whatever it was wrong. And whether it's the methodology or whether it's the something else, but I'm going with methodology and the process. That's what I'm going with. And it's funny because, as you mentioned, those particular numbers along the way were celebrated. Like, look how great the economy is. Look how many jobs we're adding. Things are really good. And then the markets would react positively. Now, on the back end of this, where we have a revision of 900 plus thousand over last year, and we saw that initial claims popped a little bit last week to 263 versus the 220 range has been or so, and the unemployment rate is at 4.3%. What's interesting to note is it was celebrated again. And it's like good news is celebrated, bad news is celebrated. It doesn't really matter. In a way, in a very twisted way, I could imagine you could write a little bit of a conspiracy thesis on how this was masterfully tied together in such a way that it put a carrot out there on a continual basis, just enough to keep people interested that things were good. And when it got bad, that the Fed would come to the rescue. I'm not going as far as that, but is it possible?
Well, yeah, I mean, look, the markets still are looking for bad news because they want the Fed to cut. That is the economic or monetary heroin that they need. And so anything that makes the Fed cut rates is bullish for the stock market, unfortunately. And that's what happened today. You know, we got, I thought, bad news on the CPI. The CPI was up more than they thought, of 0.4. And if you annualize it, that's 5% inflation. But of course, you know, it's headed higher. It's 5% and rising, right? More than double the 2% theoretical target. Yet we had a huge spike in unemployment claims for the week, the biggest in like 4 years, or the highest level now of weekly claims in 4 years. And that's why the Dow's up more than 500 points is because, oh, this cements the cut because we've got this weak labor market. And of course, a weak labor market also means a weak economy. And in fact, the year of jobs revisions that year, it went from April 2024 to March of 2025. It turns out that the only jobs that got created during that year were government jobs and government-related jobs, like healthcare. So the private sector actually lost jobs. The entire time they were talking about how strong the labor market was, we were losing private sector jobs. Those are the important jobs. Those are the ones that pay the bills. They pay the taxes that employ the government jobs. The government jobs are a net drain on the economy. And so if all we're creating is government jobs, that is a huge, huge problem.
If you think about what he's saying there, folks, I want to mention something because I want to tell me what you think. Basically, the government jobs that are coming in, the taxes that are paid on the, let's even include Social Security for a minute. Let's include everything. And let's go crazy. Let's say a government employee pays 50% taxes. Let's just say that just for the discussion, okay? You're paying X amount of dollars and only getting back 50%. Whereas a private payroll job, if it's the same exact circumstance, is paying 50% tax all in, be state, city, federal, and Social Security, let's just say, right? And that's all coming into the coffers.
Oh, yeah. Government employees don't really pay taxes. That's a fiction. If I'm the government and I have an employee and I pay my employee $70,000 and then he pays $20,000 back to me in taxes, I didn't collect anything from that guy. I gave him $50,000.
Exactly.
So, yeah. Right? So the reason that the government does it that way is so people don't think that these government workers are getting away without paying taxes. So, hey, look, we pay taxes just like everybody else. No, they don't. Government employees are tax takers. They're not taxpayers. They get money from the government.
Yeah.
But if you're in the private sector, you give money to the government, although you don't necessarily give it. They take it from you. But the government doesn't take anything from its own workers. It just reduces what it's giving them.
Right, right. It's a net loss to them, a further net loss.
Yeah.
Further net loss. So the higher the government. So it's interesting because if you look at the jobs numbers and you talk about how it was only the government jobs that really made something and we lost all this other jobs along the way, and there was a net loss of all these jobs throughout this. you know, is there something to blame on this is also a question. Is it a weak economy? You know, we see a lot of parts of the economy like the ISM manufacturing, which has been in contraction territory for a long time. Services started finally coming down. We see that the, you know, the various regional numbers are kind of okay, but not. And is there something else underfoot here? Is this the time that markets are getting it, once again, kind of a little bit right but wrong while they want the heroin of lower rates? It can't go down that much considering all the inflation. Are we in a time that is really an aha moment here, Peter?
Yeah, well, I think there is an aha moment, only most people haven't said aha yet. But I think what is happening and what we're on the verge of is a major meltdown in the dollar. And I think that's going to be precipitated by the loss of Fed independence, which, you know, the Fed has never really been that independent. I mean, everybody pretended it was, and it was that pretense that helped support the value of the dollar. But once you strip away that and expose the Fed for what it is, which is what the Trump administration is doing and what the Supreme Court may in fact uphold when they uphold his right to fire Lisa Baker, maybe on the grounds that a truly independent Fed is not constitutional and that the Fed must be beholden to an elected representative or something like that, like the president. But I think confidence is going to be lost in the dollar. It's already teetering on the brink based on the sanctions that happened under Biden, but now more threats of sanctions under Trump, in particular through tariffs. So I think the sanctions and the tariffs are alienating our friends around the world and our trading partners. You know, we're pushing our adversaries closer together. I think this whole thing is going to backfire, and we can see a precipitous drop in the dollar, which will push up consumer prices to astronomical heights. And I think we're going to kick the printing presses into overdrive. And that is what gold is already sensing. And, you know, gold's going to be moving up even higher at a faster clip than it is now. I think by next year, you'll see gold moving up more $100 and $200 a day, not 20, 30, 40, or 50, but much bigger moves. I think you'll see bigger moves in silver as the world just divests of dollars. But this is going to be a huge problem for America because we depend on the dollar's reserve status for pretty much everything that we consume.
Right. Now, what's interesting is this plays right into your playbook, Peter, because I've known you a long time, and you've always, as far as I remember, tell me if I'm wrong and just shoot me right down here, but you've always been pretty much like, hey, the dollar is vulnerable long-term, right? And, you know, I like gold. Why? It's an alternative to it. We're going to get to Bitcoin in a second because I know a lot of people want to hear about your thoughts on that as well. But this is actually, over all the years that I've thought of this, and I thought of your base thesis that I recall at least from all the times we've spoken and I've seen and I've heard and I've read your work, is that this really looks like that the dollar is in trouble. And I want to hold that, put a point, just a paperclip in that for 1 second, because I want to go back to something you said, and I want to get some clarification from you and insights. The Fed independence issue is, I think we both agree, a big concern for the dollar's worth. What is your opinion?
Oh, yeah.
But you've been critical about the Fed. What is your opinion about this whole thing? Forget about whether she has two mortgages or whatever the story is. Forget that. The Fed independence.
First of all, as I said, I don't think the Fed was ever really, truly independent. I believe that they did work behind the scenes with government, and they tried to help the government. That's, you know, they monetized their debts, and they didn't, you know, take the punch bowl away from the party like they should have. In fact, in many cases, they were the ones spiking the punch bowl, keeping the party going. But at least it was kind of, you know, an unspoken thing. It was kind of behind the scenes, and everybody pretended that that wasn't the case. But once you expose that and come clean, you know, I'm a big critic of the Fed. I mean, don't get me wrong. I think the Fed has done a horrible job. But I think that to the extent that you allow the president to call the shots, that he'll do an even worse job.
That happened to Turkey.
Yes.
How'd that work out?
Not well.
Yeah. So,
you know, but, and the same thing with Congress. Look, yeah, I'd like to get rid of the Fed and go back to the gold standard, but that's not going to happen. So the choice is the devil we know and the devil we don't know. The devil we know is the Fed that we got. The devil we don't know is the one we're about to get when it loses that independence.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's now part of the Trump administration.
Well, this all played very, very well for you, though, because you have the, you know, your Pacific Asset Management. I know you have a lot of international overseas gold, non-U.S. dollar denominated. That has been in play hard this year. It's been wonderful.
Look, gold stocks have already more than doubled on the year. Doubled, right? The best performing stock in the S&P 500 this year is Newmont Mining.
Is that right?
Now, like, you wouldn't know that from listening to the mainstream media that is still fixated on the Mag 7 or stuff like that. But gold stocks, other than, you know, maybe gambling on Fannie and Freddie and hitting a home run because of the Trump administration, you know, doing probably one of the worst things that it's going to do. And it's doing a lot of bad things, but the plan on Fannie and Freddie is horrible. But this plan will help drive gold prices to 10,000 or higher. That's the type of inflationary, reckless plan that undermines the economy and destroys the dollar. But people are not paying attention to the returns. And, you know, that's why, you know, people who were following my investment advice were lagging the S&P for years. And now we're catching up very quickly. As I said, you know, gold stocks are now beating the S&P for the last 10 years. You know, they're killing it over the last 3 years. But the S&P is still beating gold stocks over the past 20 years. But I think a year from now, that won't be the case.
Well, let me give you some.
I think a year from now, you can go back 20 years. But gold itself, gold is beating the S&P for 25 years. In fact, over the past 25 years, as I've been recommending gold, I was recommending it in 2000, 2001. Since then, the U.S. stock market has lost about 70% of its value if you price it in gold.
Right. We don't usually do that because we own dollars, but yes.
Yeah, that is a massive bear market. It's up, it's doubled in dollars, right? But who cares? The gold has gone up more than 10x.
Right. So the point would be if nothing else, just have both. Let me tell you some numbers here. Earnings per share, it's called Newmont Corporation now. They sophisticated it. It's not called mining anymore. It's Newmont Corp. NEM, price to earnings 14.4, far lower than the S&P 22 forward, right? You got gross profit margin 57%, net profit margin 29%, return on equity 20%, stocks up 113% to this year to a 52-week high right now, and its earnings and its revenue growth over the next few years are all estimated to be nicely higher and higher by, you know, 4, 5, 6, 10% per year. Not a tech stock, but for what it is, I agree with you. Some good quality stuff there.
But it's only at 14 times earnings.
Yep.
And that's basically 14 times trailing earnings, too, because analysts assume that the price of gold is not going up.
Yeah.
But the price of gold is already much higher than it was when they earned their money over the last 12 months. So the stock is not really trading at 14 times earnings. It may be under 10 times earnings based on what it's actually going to earn. But if you want to know what it's priced at based on 2027 earnings, it could be 5 or 6 times earnings because gold prices aren't going to stop rising.
Yeah, especially if the dollar comes down.
They're just going to keep earning more and more money on every ounce of gold they put out of the ground.
And think of it like this, right? The fact is people get all charged up and excited when Netflix says they're going to have a dollar increase per user spread across their total user base. And that means X amount of dollars, more revenue to them, which drops down to pretty much pure profit on the margin, right? Because you just add the price. That's the same thing you're talking about with gold.
Yeah, but here's the difference, right? When you're a company like Netflix, as you raise your prices, you are going to eat into your business. I mean, some people are going to say,
yeah,
I can't afford it, right? So as the price goes up, like if Netflix tries to double their prices, they're not going to double their revenue. There's going to be a number of customers who just quit, right? Mm-hmm. They're not going to pay the higher price. So there's less demand for Netflix as you raise the price. With gold, it's actually the other way around. The higher the price, the more people want to buy it.
Right, exactly.
So, like, if the price of gold doubles, not only does Newmont's revenue double, because they don't sell less gold because it's more expensive. They keep on buying it. They may even buy, but their profits explode because their costs don't double, right? Mm-hmm. So you're valuing Newmont not based on its revenues, but based on its profits. So if you double the revenue, you could quintuple the profits.
Right. Right, exactly. No, this, yeah. It's great. I like it. Listen, we're going to talk about, your current outlook on the U.S. economy. We have to get to Bitcoin. I want to take a quick break. We'll come right back. All right, so listen up. Let's talk about Interactive Brokers for a second here. Because at Interactive Brokers Bond Marketplace, you can access over 1 million global bonds, including global and corporate and municipal bonds all in one place. That's really important. With IBKR's bond search tool, finding and comparing yields against other brokers has never been so easy, streamlining your investment decisions. Plus, you could trade U.S. Treasuries around the clock 5 days a week, allowing you to react to markets, news, and economic events whenever they happen. And you could trade bonds with no markups or built-in spreads and low, transparent commissions, which can help you improve your returns. Rated a top online broker, Interactive Brokers has won awards from Barron's, Investopedia, Stockbrokers.com, and has been Benzinga's number one overall online broker for bonds four years in a row. Interactive Brokers is a member of SIPC. Visit IBKR.com/bonds and start trading today. All right, we're back with Peter Schiff from Euro Pacific Asset Management. I told you we're going to talk about the U.S. economy. We've been talking about that, but let's get Peter. You're one of the things that, one of the hats you wear, of course, is, you know, talking about pricing and expectations and client management. But you also do a bit of an economist, right? I think that's something you enjoy doing. Am I right?
Yeah. I mean, I'm a self-taught economist, okay, although I did take some econ classes in Berkeley. But, I spent most of my time trying to correct the mistakes of my professors. So I didn't really learn anything. Yeah. I tried to teach economics to my professors. but although I wasn't completely self-taught because I learned from my father. Mm-hmm.
So let me ask you this.
Who was also self-taught because he had the same problem when he was in college. His economics professors didn't know what they were talking about either.
It's a genetic thing. Oh, here comes Schiff again. Great. Right. So here's a question. Two questions. First, I have been a student of economics and would study charts and trends and look inside the numbers, break it down. And for a long time, early in my career, I thought that the economics were a major driver of the economy. I don't think anybody who started before, let's say, I'm just going to pick a year, the year 2000, before the year 2000, I think that was a very standard process, right? Even if you were a bottoms up kind of person, you'd still look at the top down economic condition of things and all that. However, over the last 5 years or so, I have been like, you know what? Some of this economic stuff is just not telling me anything about what's going to happen in the near term or the long term. Or I don't know about the long term because it hasn't been long enough, but it hasn't told me what I need to know about the markets. What's different now? And, or maybe tell me that I'm full of shit.
About what? I missed it.
About whether or not the economics today are really important to the markets.
Well, they're important to me because I'm a big macro guy and I can't help but view everything from that perspective and trying to invest for the end game, not just trying to ride whatever wave of momentum happens to capture the fancy of the public or even professional investors. I think right now it's all just been about liquidity and the Fed and, TINA, like no alternative, whatever they call that anachronism was, there's no alternative and everybody just keeps piling in and it becomes a self-perpetuating situation where the more money chases a small number of stocks, the better those stocks do. And the better those stocks do, the more money that wants to get in. And so it kind of feeds on itself until eventually it implodes on itself. Mm. And we haven't gotten to that point yet. But it seems like every time we do get to a point where the market's imploding, the Fed backs up the truck and, you know, cranks up the presses to bail it out. So and I think most of the people who are managing larger pools of other people's money, you know, don't even understand economics. They don't get it. They they've been living in this fantasy world of monetary heroin for so long that they're just numb to it. They just don't know. And even a lot of Republicans, a lot of people have bought into the MAGA nonsense, like that stuff that Trump is saying. But none of this stuff is going to work. All this stuff is going to backfire. It's throwing gasoline on a fire.
Yeah, no, I hear you. So when it comes to the economy today, then, where we are today, looking forward with the information we know, are we talking about recession, stagflation, something else entirely? What's the near and midterm outlook?
Well, you know, I do think it's stagflation, but I don't think it's going to be stagflation light. I hear a lot of people say, well, it's not going to be as bad as the 70s. I think they're wrong. I think it's going to be worse than the 70s. So it's going to be stagflation heavy, where it's not just a stagnant economy. We're going to be in a worse recession than the Great Recession that we had after the financial crisis. So serious economic contraction, but we're going to have higher inflation than we had during the 70s.
Hmm. Really?
So
when is that projected? Because we just had a bout that was pretty ugly, not terrible, not 70s style, but it was enough to be like, oh, that didn't feel so
no,
good.
No, it was 70s style. What are you talking about? I mean, like,
they didn't have to crack it.
Well, we got to 9%, right, for 1 year.
Yeah.
But if we measured prices during that year, the way they measured them during the 70s, it would have been about 18%.
Mm.
You know, we don't have the same CPI that we had back then.
Yeah.
And, you know, the highest inflation ever got back then was maybe 11, 12% for 1 year. It didn't get much higher than the 9, but that was with a much more honest CPI. So I think that right now, I mean, we're having pretty high inflation. As I said, that if you annualize the number that we just got today, that's 5% inflation. But that's probably 10% inflation if you had a more honest CPI.
Yeah, I'm looking at a chart right now on a company called Shadow Stats, which you probably are familiar with. He does great work. He's been on the show many times. And we're looking at, actually, if you look back to 2000 and, oh, this just goes back, I don't know if I click this chart here, but you look back and you see that the rate of inflation came down, but it was still on the 1990 based, which is obviously the alternative they have, which is past the 1970s, obviously. We're still at like 8%, he's showing.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
That's pretty hot.
Oh, yeah. And the Fed is talking about 2%. Like, oh, yeah, we're just near 2%. They're not even in the ballpark at 2%.
Yeah. So it's pretty scary times. I agree with that. And it's funny because most people know it but don't want to admit it going out. Listen, I'm in Florida. We got fish everywhere down here, right? Local fish is mahi-mahi. I went to a store here, a regular grocery store. I was just puttering around looking for something else. I happened upon the fish area. You know, the fish, it was $34 a pound for mahi-mahi. That's not even funny. That's like a $4, $5, $8 fish down here. $34. Oh, yeah.
Do you know 90% of our seafood is imported?
Yeah.
You'd figure with all these oceans and rivers and lakes, you figure we could catch our own fish.
I've been out there. It's not so easy. But yeah, I get it. I get it. So let's talk a little bit about something that I think is important, because of all the things that are going on that could go wrong, that could be beneficial for a while, but then burst, in your opinion. One of the things that's interesting is you have a much different opinion on something that is very near to dear to a lot of people, and that is cryptocurrency and Bitcoin. I mean, you know, I got to ask that because I'm getting texts already for people that know you're coming on. It's like, hey, did you ask him? So the question that keeps coming up, you know, is anything changed in your mind about Bitcoin? And by the way, to be totally upfront with you, I am not an advocate of Bitcoin as a gold alternative, just to be clear. I think Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies, or whatever you want to call them exactly, are an interesting speculative asset. Have at it with you with that in mind. But you have been a critic, and you even, I said once that, you know, Bitcoin is worthless, which, by the way, from a fundamental value, I think that is true, but that is going to go to zero. Tell me a little bit about where you are now.
Yeah, well, it's funny because you started off the conversation asking about me being a contrarian.
Yeah.
And so I'm even a contrarian in the Bitcoin world, because the Bitcoiners think they're the contrarians, right? But I'm a contrarian to them. It's not, And, you know, because I was at the Bitcoin conference, the last one in Las Vegas, there were 35,000 people in attendance. And I was probably the only one who was anti-Bitcoin or, you know, negative on Bitcoin. But I was probably the most popular person there because everybody knew me. And a lot of people, you know, credited me for buying Bitcoin. Now, I say they'll eventually blame me for buying Bitcoin because they're going to end up losing money in it.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, look, I think Bitcoin is just another, you know, speculative bubble. I don't think there's any real value in Bitcoin or any of these other altcoins that people gamble with. You're right. I mean, they are speculative tokens. And to the extent that there's a buyer there, then there's a market. And to the extent that the sellers want to hold because they expect a moonshot, you know, Michael Saylor says Bitcoin's going to go to 10 million or 20 million. And so never sell your Bitcoin. So if the people that own their Bitcoin don't want to get rid of it and more people want to buy, the price is going to go up. Yes, I mean, that's going to happen. But the problem becomes when you run out of new buyers and the holders eventually want to sell, whether they want to or whether they just need the money. And then at some point, the bottom drops out because there's nothing of real value there. It's all about the speculation. I'm buying Bitcoin because I believe I can sell it to somebody else at a higher price. Well, why is that person going to buy it? Well, because he has the same belief. Well, when you run out of greater fools, the whole thing collapses. And, you know, the Bitcoin community, especially the OGs, that the big guys that are, you know, have the big whale wallets, they've done a great job of promoting this thing. And then when they kind of ran out of suckers in the private market, they got Wall Street in on the game to come up with all these ETFs. And then when they started running out of demand there, they took over the Trump administration, or first they got Trump elected and then
they were definitely helpful. They had some plenty of political money to spread around.
Well, yeah, the Bitcoin, that was the largest donors came from crypto. And now Trump has basically not only embraced the industry, it's now his family business. They're all in on crypto. His cabinet is all crypto. He's got a crypto czar. They've got a crypto Bitcoin strategic reserve, a crypto stockpile, and a Bitcoin strategic reserve. But here's the interesting thing. The high point for Bitcoin 4 years ago, October of 2021, Bitcoin today is more than 15% lower than it was 4 years ago in gold.
On gold, right? Okay.
So in terms of gold, and Bitcoin is presenting itself as the alternative to gold. It's digital gold, right? It's better than gold. You know, gold is the analog Bitcoin. Bitcoin is digital, right? So 4 years ago, over those 4 years, Bitcoin is down 15% in terms of gold. Now, what's happened over those 4 years? All the Bitcoin ETFs were launched. None of them existed 4 years ago. We had the entire NFT craze that hadn't happened. You had El Salvador make it, you know, the official legal tender. You had Michael Saylor begin to buy tens of billions worth. Then you had all the copycat Bitcoin treasury companies who have been buying it up. Then you had the Trump administration, the Bitcoin presidency, all that. Despite all of that, massive hype, Super Bowl ads, celebrity endorsements, all this stuff, Bitcoin's gone down. Yeah, it's gone up in dollars, but so is everything else, right? But in terms of real money, in terms of gold, you'd have been better off 4 years ago just putting it all in gold.
Right. So when you talk about I think it's important because I think some people would have a hard time wrapping themselves around this. When you keep talking about the idea, this in terms of gold, it's a relative discussion. You're saying, when you say that, you're saying that gold outperformed.
Well, I'm saying, right, but Bitcoin went down priced in gold. If gold is real money, right?
Yep.
You can buy more Bitcoin with an ounce of gold today than you could 4 years ago. So the price of gold in terms of Bitcoin has gone down. Now, the price of stocks have also gone down.
The price of Bitcoin.
Just about everything. The point is, Bitcoin was hyped up as a alternative to gold in that it was going to be better, right? You should buy Bitcoin instead of gold. Well, if you did, you're worse off. You should have just bought gold. And, you know, and that's going to continue because I think the bottom is going to drop out of this scheme. It's just a pyramid. It's a, you know, it's a Ponzi. Gold is real. Gold is real money. Gold has actual value. And so more people are going to figure that out. I think what helped power Bitcoin originally, the reason Bitcoin went from nothing to, you know, 50, 60,000, 70,000, that initial move, is because gold went sideways from 2011 to 2024. The price of gold went sideways. And so a lot of people got frustrated with gold. They had expected it to go up. And that kind of allowed an opening for Bitcoin to capture a lot of gold's, you know, thunder, because gold, Bitcoin was going up while gold was going sideways. Well, gold's not going sideways anymore. Gold's going up. It's going up more than Bitcoin. And so now I think a lot of that frustrated money that went into Bitcoin and left gold is going to go back to gold. The problem is it's going to be very hard to get it out of Bitcoin because there's not a lot of buyers there.
Yeah. Well, one thing you have to admit, is, and you're making the case to yourself, that the Bitcoin marketing slash development slash megaphone is pretty darn powerful, and they have really created a really cool mousetrap to promote it. There's nothing like that in the gold industry, let's be honest.
No, well, because, you know, there's not as much money to be made promoting gold. I mean, I know I sell gold, Shift Gold. We don't make very much money when you buy gold from us. We make like 1%. It's not a big markup. Now, there are some gold companies that rip people off and they charge 40, 50% for crap coins. Yes. But, you know, in the scheme of things, that's not that much money because it's not a big sector. Right. There's so much that's being made in crypto because you make these crypto tokens for nothing and then you sell them for a lot of money. So there are a lot of people who are getting rich on crypto, but they're getting rich because other people are dumb enough to buy it. That's why they're getting rich. They're not creating any value. They're not producing any wealth. They're just sucking money away from other people. Now, a lot of people have lost money in Bitcoin. They just don't know it yet because they haven't sold, right? So they think they've made money because they have these tokens and on paper, they have a certain value, but they're not selling. So they haven't really made anything. Mm. But when they try to sell, and so does everybody else, the price collapses.
You're talking about,
and then
you're
they realize about, yeah, how much money they lost.
You're talking about a big rug pull is what you're talking about. And the fact that all of a sudden everybody wants to sell at cascades and there's not the liquidity out there that potentially could be. I want to ask you a question about—
And this is a giant, look, this is a giant pump and dump. And now the pumpers are the Trump administration. The U.S. government is pumping up Bitcoin so Trump's friends can unload their Bitcoin on the public.
And they're doing a hell of a job of it, aren't they?
Well, they've done a pretty damn good job.
Yeah, really good.
There's so much selling that the price hasn't gone up. I mean, Bitcoin is what? What is it? 112,000? 100?
Right around there.
Yeah. I mean, but it was the same price 3 months ago.
Yep. Let me ask you one question. Pick your brain about something. Since you know about gold coins, I happen to own a bunch of gold coins. I have 1982 to 1988 China pandas. Perfect condition. Good stuff?
Well, I mean, I don't know if there's any collector value there, but I mean, if they're made of gold and they're 1 ounce coins, they're worth their weight in gold.
Yeah, exactly. There you go. There you go. Talk to me about Austrian economics. Explain what it is really quickly and why you're a big advocate.
Well, as far as I'm concerned, Austrian economics is economics. I mean, it's like, you know, what's the difference between astronomy and astrology? Well, astronomy is an actual science. Astrology is just a bunch of BS, right?
Yeah, okay.
And so the economics that most people believe in, whether it's Keynesian, supply side, monetarists, whatever, I think that's the equivalent of astrology, especially Keynesianism. But Austrian economics is really rooted in true economics, the Wealth of Nations, Adam Smith, and then expanded by Mises. But Austrian economics is what allowed me to know that the 2008 financial crisis was coming. It allows me to understand the unintended consequences of government policies that catch everybody by surprise. You know, when we had the 2008 financial crisis, the idea was that it was some kind of black swan that nobody could have saw coming. When it was something that was so obvious, I saw it from a mile away because I was looking at it from the prism of the Austrian school. But they weren't. And so all the stuff that happens that surprises people is because they don't really understand economics. If they understood it, they wouldn't be surprised when the obvious happens. But it's not obvious if you don't understand it.
Yeah. No, I get that. I get that entirely. And it's funny because...
And the Austrian school does understand the business cycle and how governments cause it, but also the Austrian school understands that the problem of the business cycle is during the boom, when everybody else is happy. That's when the problems occur. That's when the mistakes are made.
Well, the excess.
The recession, right? The recession is, from the Austrian perspective, that's the good thing. That's when the mistakes are corrected, right? That's when, you know, you pay the piper and fix the mistakes and lay the foundation for a real economic growth. But the Keynesian theory and the modern theory is that we should try to perpetuate the booms as long as possible and mitigate the busts, which is the worst thing you could do. Because what you're doing is you're causing the disease and then you're preventing the cure by giving the patient more of the disease.
Right. This is the old forest burning and not growing and not allowing it to burn down. You know, with that in mind, there has been some discussion that the traditional economic cycle, trough to peak, you know, back around and all that, the whole psychology behind it is dead. The Fed is not going to let it happen, right? No matter what happens, they're going to adjust and they're going to come in. They're going to provide more monetary policy stimulus through some mechanism or another. Never let anything go down like they didn't let, for example, in the latest banking situation, you know, the Signature Banks, all those guys really didn't let anybody fail during that. What did they do? Well, the banks loaded up on all this debt that was long term and they just kept it on their books. And all of a sudden, the valuations of the banks' assets went down precipitously as interest rates came up. And the Fed came in and said, don't worry about it. We guarantee we'll buy it back for full price from you right now and making a satisfaction of the books and records that they required. So if in fact, I'm throwing this out there, not saying it's absolutely correct, but if in fact the economic cycle is dead, does that really create even a bigger problem long term?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think that the problem is going to come in this cycle. This is, I think, going to be the equivalent of the monetary overdose. Because the Trump administration and the Fed are going to be under the impression that if they just do what they did before, they'll get the same result. You know, and I'm talking about the monetary and fiscal policy that we had after the stock market crash the big tech bubble burst in 2001, 2002, the stock market or financial crisis of 2008, the COVID crisis of 2020, they're going to do the exact same thing that they did then. They're going to slash interest rates and print a bunch of money. But given where we are right now, I don't believe we're going to get high like we did before. I think we're going to OD. And that means that the dollar is going to collapse because this time, the fourth time, will not be the charm. The fourth time, the world does not want our dollars. They're already selling them. They're already buying gold. And so the dollar is going to fall rather precipitously, and that is going to put upward pressure on interest rates and consumer prices. So that's why this recession is going to be so much worse than the prior recessions, because it's going to be accompanied by higher interest rates and much higher consumer prices. And so the way the Fed has been able to stimulate the economy is its ability to lower rates without crashing the dollar. But once it can't do that anymore, then the cure actually, or the stimulus becomes a sedative. The more they try to stimulate the economy with cheap money, the more they end up sedating it. So the Fed is actually going to harm the economy it's trying to help. Now, of course, it was always doing long-term harm. That was why I was opposed to it. But at least it helped in the short run, right? But now it's not even going to help in the short run. It's going to hurt in the short run and the long run.
Yeah. So let me try to encapsulate this for you and tell me what you think. We have monetary heroin that keeps on being pumped into the system for many years on and off. This time it's going to be a monetary overdose, but this time there's no monetary Narcan. Is that basically the point?
Yes.
How long do we have to go?
I don't know.
Well, come on. We need to know that answer.
I can't tell you, but look, the fuse is a lot shorter than it was. How long? But look at what's going on with gold. You know, that tells you that, you know, time is running out. I think when the Fed cuts rates, next week, I think, is that's when they're supposed to meet, right?
Mm-hmm.
Next week?
16th, yeah. 17th, something like that.
If the bond market really gets a hit, takes a hit on that rate cut, that could be a sign that, you know, it's coming.
Yeah.
And look at the dollar. I mean, look watch for a bigger crack in the dollar. I mean, the dollar's down on the year quite a bit, but it's been hanging out these last few months. It hasn't really made new lows. Hasn't recovered, but it hasn't made new lows. But if we start to see the dollar hitting fresh lows, the bond market going down, long-term rates rising, and gold continuing to spike, you know, that's a pretty good sign that we're running out of time.
Yeah, I hear you. Speaking about running out of time, thank you, Peter Schiff, Euro Pacific Capital and Asset Management and gold. And we're going to have all the information on where people can get to. But you can tell me also over on the show notes for episode number 938. How do people see you, watch you, hear you, get you, all that?
Well, first of all, Schiff Gold, if you want to buy some gold and silver, which I would recommend. I mean, if you don't own any, you need to own it. At least 5-10% of your, you know, overall portfolio should have physical gold and silver, take custody of it, you know, have it with you. And so we can deliver it to you at Schiff Gold. So just go to schiffgold.com and you can either load up your shopping cart or you can talk to one of my representatives that will help you pick out what to buy. And nobody will pressure you and no one will bait and switch you into these overpriced coins because we don't sell them. We just sell the real stuff. I mentioned gold stocks. Even though they've more than doubled this year, they are still very cheap. I think they could double again next year, maybe triple next year, even though they've already doubled. I mean, the thing is, nobody even talks about them. Nobody's buying these stocks. Nobody owns these stocks. They're completely off of everybody's radar.
It's not sexy. It's not sexy. Let's be honest. You may think it's sexy. It's sexy to you. But yeah, but a lot of people don't.
So, you know, I got a gold fund, the Euro Pacific Gold Fund, EPIGX is the no load symbol. You can buy my fund anywhere on any discount broker. What makes my fund so valuable right now is we have a lot of private placements that are not being counted in our value. Mm. And so as the market's gone up this year, we've lagged performance-wise because we have all these stocks that haven't gone up, but they've actually gone up. We just can't price them. But when these companies go public, all of a sudden, it's going to be a big deal. But we've got a great portfolio. I think people are going to make a ton of money in these stocks. Yeah, there's risk, but relative to the potential, I don't think you could beat it anywhere else in the market. So if you're willing to take a risk, I think for my money, and my money is pretty much a lot in gold stocks, that's where you want to go. But we have broad portfolios. You know, my dividend payer strategy, get this, I have a mutual fund that just invests in foreign dividend paying stocks. It's up over 42% this year.
Yeah.
This year.
Yeah.
Utilities, real estate trusts, pharmaceutical companies, tobacco companies, food and beverage companies, right? Basic companies that pay dividends, 42%. So this is what's going on. People are pulling their money out of the US market and investing internationally. This is a trend that I believe is going to continue for many, many years. And it's still early. So if you want to get information on all of our strategies, all of our funds, transfer an account over to us, You can go to my website at europac.com, EUROPAC.com. I also put out a newsletter, a free newsletter. You can subscribe to that at shiftsovereign.com. Two or three emails per week will arrive in your inbox. They're free, right? And there's a lot of good insight in there. And if you want to listen to me, you know, I do the Peter Schiff Show podcast at least once a week, sometimes twice, depending on, you know, what's going on and how much time I have. But you can listen to it on my YouTube channel, Peter Schiff, also on shiftradio.com or anywhere they have podcasts. I'm going to be doing another one, I think, tonight, I think. And then follow me on social media. I mean, I'm on Facebook, I'm on YouTube, I said, I'm on Instagram, TikTok, but, you know, where I spend the most time is on X. That's where I've got almost 1.2 million followers. So X, you definitely got to follow me there because I'm constantly putting my thoughts out real time. Nobody does that for me. I do them all. I write them all myself. So when you're following me on X, you're following me.
Love it. Love it. Love it. Love it. Hey, thanks for coming on. We'll get to do this again one day real soon when you're down in Fort Lauderdale. Let's have a drink.
Yeah, you know, I was there not that long ago. My next trip to Florida is Orlando coming up next month.
All right. Very good. A little bit far from me, but we'll do it. I'll see you soon, buddy. Thanks.
All right. Take care.
Thanks. Whew. That was pretty intense. I loved it. Talked about a lot of things all the way from monetary heroin to Bitcoin going to zero. We talked about Austrian economics. We talked about U.S. dollar teetering. We talk about everything that's going on in the economy. So what else can you ask for in this, right? Thanks for joining me this week. Next week, it turns out, it's going to be a great week. Great people coming aboard over the next. I have some great guests. Don't forget to listen to DH Unplugged as well. And make sure to visit the site where you find everything you need to know about us over on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Thanks for joining me again. I'll see you again real soon. This podcast is intended for informational purposes only and does not constitute personalized investment advice. Investing involves risk, including the possible loss of principal, and past performance is not indicative of future results. The views and opinions expressed are those of the host and any guests and may not necessarily reflect those of Horowitz & Company, Inc., an investment advisor registered with the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. Registration with the SEC does not imply a certain level of training or skill. Advisory services are only offered to a client or prospective clients where Horowitz & Company is properly registered or is excluded from registration requirements. Any mention of third-party companies, products, or services is provided for informational purposes only and does not constitute an endorsement. Hypothetical scenarios or forward-looking statements are for illustrative purposes and should not be viewed as guarantees. Content is intended for U.S. residents only and may not be applicable in other jurisdictions. Listeners should consult a qualified financial advisor before making any investment decisions. Please visit our website for additional information, disclosures, as well as a copy of our Form CRS. Advertisements are not related to the host or affiliates and are not considered recommendations by the host of the show or any affiliates of Horowitz & Company.